Welcome, action fans, and thanks for joining us for another edition of All 90s Action All the Time, as we continue our look at some of the most notable action films of 1993. I'm your host, Scott Murphy, and on this month's episode, we are looking at the Dolph Lundgren vehicle, Joshua Tree, aka Army of One. Alongside me to talk about this one, we have a very special guest, as we have managed to bring in the world's greatest Dolph Lundgren expert and the host of the Dolph Dedicated Podcast, I Must Break This Podcast, Mr. Sean Malloy. Welcome, Sean.
Wow, man, that could be probably the most complimentary intro I've ever had. So thank you for that. I hope I can live up to the moniker that you just established there. Thank you.
Well, you know, I started listening to your podcast last year. I was not a big Dolph guy, and I've gone like down a little bit of a Dolph rabbit hole courtesy of your podcast. So like in my eyes, you are the number one Dolph guy.
Well, I appreciate that. Yeah, no, you know, when I started the show up, gosh, has it been almost 6 years now, I think. Yeah, when I started the show up, it was interesting. It's been a fun journey, I'll say that. And I've kind of been saying it on my show, but I'm kind of getting near the end of the show. I see the end in sight, so I'm going to be wrapping it up here. I'm thinking probably within the next year, just because I'm going to be caught up with Mr. Lundgren's filmography. But yeah, I mean, out of all the action guys, I think he has certainly had a fascinating career. I mean, and the fact that he's still around, I mean, that's the other thing that we have to acknowledge with Mr. Lundgren is, I mean, you look, he started in 1985. And if you look at all of the action stars that were birthed in throughout the 80s and the 90s, not many of them are still doing it. You know what I mean? Like Arnold obviously has that Netflix show, but I think for the most part, he seems to be kind of done making the movies, you know, and unless it's Rocky or Rambo, same thing with Stallone. But the fact that, you know, Lundgren, he's a survivor. I think a lot of my guests on the show have echoed the same thing. He's a survivor and he has been able to survive and transcend the direct-to-video realm and get back on the big screen multiple times and then continue thriving in the small independent direct-to-video realm. And so I think that's commendable for so many reasons.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And like you say, he definitely has staying power. And I think, yeah, a lot of the other action stars, like you say, are kind of popping in and out of things. You know, Stallone obviously has that new show. And, you know, I think the latest Expendables is kind of going to be just a extended cameo. And you know, same with Arnie. And, you know, he just pops up and does the occasional thing. And Jean-Claude, he's kind of in semi-retirement. And there's a lot of them who are just kind of like taking things here and there. But like I've seen from Dolph Lundgren's filmography that he's still pumping them out 3-4 movies a year kind of thing. So like, yeah, he's definitely got some stamina.
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, in the film that you invited me on for, I mean, this works out wonderfully for me as well, mainly because, yeah, when I covered Joshua Tree, Army of One, I want to say that was that episode was back in, I'm pretty sure, I think it was 2018 or so, around that time when I recorded and released it. And it was one episode that, I mean, gosh, we're going to be talking about this film. I mean, because it is, I think, very underrated. It's, for the most part, pretty unseen. I don't think many really know about it. And on that particular episode, we really just kind of glossed over the film and some of the aspects of it. And obviously, I'm not expecting to do a comprehensive scene-by-scene analysis of the film. But I do think that this is one particular film that deserves a second look. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to re-examine the film, because I don't think I did the best job in doing that. It was still pretty early on in my show as well. So
that's cool. I'm glad that I could do that for you.
Welcome to Joshua Tree, a nice, quiet place in the sun. Dolph Lundgren, a nice, quiet guy.
I see you turned out exactly like we all hoped.
On the wrong side of the law. George Siegel, a tough cop. With a badge.
Makes no difference to me who makes this arrest. City, county, anything.
You like him?
I always liked him. But I'm gonna kill him.
Kristen Alfonso.
Police officer.
A tougher cop. Who just got caught.
Don't shoot, he's got a hot.
In the middle. Fasten your seatbelts and hang on for the ride of your life.
Why do you want to die?
You want to know what happened then? Watch what happens now.
A warrant was issued 40 minutes ago for the arrest of Deputy Marek. She is to be considered not as an abductee, but as an accomplice.
It's willpower.
Don't underestimate him. He's dangerous.
Horsepower.
Tick, tock, tick, tock.
And firepower.
Time's up.
At 160 miles per hour. Because when it comes to getting even.
I want it all tonight, or everyone goes down.
He's taking revenge into overdrive. Joshua Tree.
Before we do kind of examine the film, for the listeners, I usually give some background details on the film. So Joshua Tree was somewhat unusually released in Japan first on March the 27th, 1993. And was released internationally, theatrically, in various territories, but not in the US, where it made its debut on HBO on October 19th, 1994. And it was kind of the same in the UK. It went direct to video in the UK, which might go some way to explain why it is one of his more underseen films from this time period. It was directed by Vic Armstrong, who doesn't have a lot of notable directing credits, apart from the Nicolas Cage bomb Left Behind, but I'm sure any action fan worth their salt will know Mr. Armstrong for his legendary stunt work. It was written by Stephen Pressfield, whose notable credits include the likes of Above the Law and Free Jack. Critically, it is currently sitting on a 5.7 out of 10 on IMDb. It doesn't have a Metacritic score. It's got 51% on Rotten Tomatoes based on 4 reviews and a 3.0 on Letterboxd. And despite it being released theatrically in some territories, there doesn't seem to be any box office information. I think at this time, they were a bit more slack when it came to the international box office, counting the international box office as compared to the US box office, which obviously it didn't have because it then wasn't released theatrically there. So that's the background details on Joshua Tree, aka Army of One. Now, as we start this conversation, usually I ask the guests if they've seen the film. Obviously, that would be a somewhat moot question when it comes to asking yourself. So just tell us a little bit about your relationship to this film, where you first saw it, and kind of where this fits in the career of Mr. Lundgren.
Oh, wow. Yeah, this is a really interesting one. At least here in the States, what's interesting about it is it came out on VHS, courtesy of Live Entertainment, who is one of the many direct-to-video companies that Lionsgate later absorbed. And then Artisan Entertainment ended up putting it out on DVD back in the early 2000s. And then about 8, 9 years ago or so, Shout Factory put out a special edition Blu-ray of the film that had a making of featurette and everything. Unfortunately, that particular disc has since gone out of print. And so finding this particular film, again, at least here in the States, is pretty hard to come by. What's interesting about this one is this was Lundgren's follow-up to Universal Soldier. And if you can go back this far, if you remember this time, when Universal Soldier came out, that was a film that was putting two action stars in their prime against each other. Okay, you had Jean-Claude Van Damme and Dolph Lundgren squaring off. And what's great about that movie is it got people talking, not just about Jean-Claude, because he was kind of a rising name, But Dolph had kind of been around, you know, thanks to Rocky IV and Masters of the Universe. But I don't think people, I guess it's safe to say maybe audiences kind of forgot about him slightly. And with Universal Soldier, it put him back on the map. It put him back on people's radar. I distinctly remember when Universal Soldier came out, it seemed like it got a ton of attention, mainly due to Lundgren's performance. Because if you've seen Universal Soldier, he's off the rails in that movie. I mean, he is absolutely just completely unhinged. He's easily, I think, one of the most memorable things about it. And so you'd think, okay, after a performance like that, his follow-up film would get a lot of attention. The follow-up film was the one we're talking about, Army of One. I'm pretty sure that he filmed this pretty quickly after Universal Soldier, because if you look at his appearance in the film, he's still kind of rocking that pseudo-shaved head that he had in Universal Soldier. So I think that the turnaround, or that the interim between both films was pretty quick. But what's interesting is, yeah, like so many of the films in Lundgren's filmography, this was intended to be a theatrical release, but for reasons that I still don't really understand, the powers that be determined it wasn't going to do well theatrically. And it was unfairly just dumped on HBO. It premiered on HBO in 1993, I believe. I didn't have HBO at the time, so I was not able to watch it then. So I had to wait for it to come to rental and watched it then, obviously. And I immediately loved it. I mean, there's so much that we can say about the film, but what's really cool about it is if you go from Universal Soldier, where he is just this completely off the rails, bigoted psychopath, okay, it would have been an easy route for him to choose another villain role, but instead he chose a good guy role, but there are shades of gray. You know what I mean? He's kind of in between, but he's still on the good side that you're rooting for. But for the most part, he's playing a regular guy, which is kind of cool, which I think outside of, I mean, I guess you could say I Come in Peace or Dark Angel, he's a regular cop. You know what I mean? But with this particular film, he's just simply a truck driver, car thief who, you know, happens to be in phenomenal shape and is amazingly talented with a gun, as evidenced in the warehouse shootout scene, which we'll talk about. But that's pretty much it. So yeah, that was my experience. I of course bought the VHS. It was a budget VHS, I remember. And then got the DVD that was put out by Artisan. And then picked up the Shout Factory Blue that has now since gone out of print. But yeah, that's kind of my experience with the film in a nutshell.
Yeah, I did notice that it is quite difficult to get a hold of. Like, I had created the schedule of like what films I wanted to look at this season for this year, and before kind of looking at where things were streaming, and I noticed, I was like, oh my god, this isn't streaming anywhere. But thankfully, a very kind person put it on YouTube in decent quality. So you can watch it on YouTube in decent quality. And I did manage to watch it there. So but yeah, it has really kind of fallen off the radar, this movie. So I was, as we kind of get into the start of the film, it's always a good sign when a film starts with Ken Foree, who I just, Dawn of the Dead is one of like my kind of top five films of all time. So like I always like seeing Ken Foree in a movie, even if he is in this movie for about a minute. But he's surprisingly high billed in the movie for a person who is in it for so little. Just this opening scene and then flashbacks of this opening scene that happened kind of twice in the film, once in a dream and once in just kind of a kind of flashback, normal flashback.
Yeah, no, I would agree. I would agree. And I mean, but if we go back to Universal Soldier, I mean, and I said this on my episode, but it's interesting. Okay, I feel like that particular film, with regard to Jean-Claude Van Damme's career, I mean, the film had the intended effect. Because it catapulted, I mean, Van Damme was already kind of a rising name at that point, but it suddenly catapulted him to where he was getting bigger, more high profile projects. What's really interesting though is if you look at Jean-Claude's follow-up film, that's what I think is so fascinating about these guys, is how Van Damme's career and Dolph's career almost oddly kind of parallel one another. But if you look at Jean-Claude Van Damme, his follow-up film was Nowhere to Run, okay, which has him kind of playing this unassuming car thief who's, you know, put in a situation where he's a little over his head. And that particular film takes place in this completely, I mean, if you look at the look of Nowhere to Run compared to Joshua Tree, not only are the two characters similar, but they both films have a very similar look to them, okay, because they both take place, for the most part, 98% of each of these films is in daylight, okay, like just a stark, bright, you know, heat-drenched daylight. And both characters are these, you know, escaped convict car thieves, if you will. You know what I mean? Like, they're good guys, but again, like I said earlier, they're kind of shades of gray characters. You know what I mean? Where, you know, obviously we want to root for them, but it's not like they were living their lives completely on the just moral side of the law. You know what I mean?
I think they are. I'm not sure if they're like full anti-heroes, because like this movie does a very kind of 80s, 90s action movie thing where the character that Lundgren is playing, Wellman Anthony Santi, which is a great character name, it's fun to say, he is obviously a kind of in-between character, if it, you know, to use wrestling terminology, he's a bit of a tweener. But he's not like a kind of full-on anti-hero, because it does that very thing of the time where we make sure to know that at heart he's a good guy. You know, this is obviously skipping forward a bit, but Ken Free dies in the opening scene. And we get a scene a little bit later where Lundgren's character meets Ken Free's character's son, and it gives him a kind of anti-crime pep talk. And this is like to notify us that, like, yes, he's an escaped convict. Yes, he's a car thief. Yes, he's a bit on the edge. But, you know, he's got a heart of gold, really, deep down.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that's something that, I don't know, like a little bit later, they might not have needed to put that in, just to make sure that you know that, like, he is essentially a good guy. It's not like, because there's, I think that's maybe like the difference between like American cinema and certainly like kind of European cinema. There's no need to kind of coddle the audience. Like if you watch like some of the original Django films or whatever, you know, that guy is just like, he's barely a hero. And I think like there's less kind of like that need to kind of comfort people that you're rooting for the good guy. In the kind of that little bit of difference between European cinema and American cinema. I don't know if you feel the same way.
No, I definitely do. And I think when you paint your character with with that particular paintbrush, okay, then it makes it excusable when, how do I want to say this? It makes it excusable when we see the character resorting to violence. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like there's the scene later on in the film where, if you want to back up, when Santi, okay, first of all, he kidnaps a woman, okay? And he kidnaps this particular woman. And then when she, there's the scene on the street where she tries to escape him and the police are trying to arrest him, he is just letting loose with a shotgun. And he is shotgunning everything, okay? Storefront windows and parking meters and everything. And you're kind of like, wow, this is the good guy here. Okay. You know what I mean? Like it kind of it allows for some misdirection, which is earned, I think, in many respects.
Yes. Although I do think that scene also counts towards making sure you know he's not a villain, making sure that you know that you are supporting the good guy. So while he is firing off the shotgun, which is kind of crazy behavior, he's deliberately firing into what we presume are like empty shops, you know, like, I mean, I think we're supposed to guess that these shops are empty, and he's deliberately missing the police officers because, you know, at this stage, he's being painted by the police as like a cop killer, the corrupt police that we'll get into, as a cop killer. So I think that this is supposed to be shown as like an act of almost kindness to show to, you know, the female character Rita, played by Christian Alfonso, that he, you know, he's not just some psycho killer.
Well, and Sian, I think I would almost, I mean, I see where you're coming with that. I would almost slightly disagree with that in a way, because okay. The film's really interesting with how it does it. Because if you think about it, we really don't fully, I mean, we're kind of on Santee's side a little bit, kind of in the beginning, but we don't fully get on his side until we see that the police are crooked, and then we hear Santee's side of the story. Okay. Mm-hmm. And yeah. Christine Alfonso, the Rita character, she's kind of the audience surrogate to, you know, we're kind of following her, and we're discovering that he is an innocent man right about at the same time she is discovering it too. And so, like I said, I certainly see where you're coming with that, but I also think that was the writing and the direction's way of, you know what I mean? Again, kind of applying a little bit of misdirect, you know what I mean? To where, okay, he is a bad dude. Why we're following this bad dude for 40 minutes so far, you know, I hope he's going to be good. You know what I mean?
Although I did find that you're right, that the Rita character is an audience surrogate, but sometimes I found that slightly frustrating, because I found that in terms of the writing, she, as the audience surrogate, was slightly behind the audience, so sometimes reiterated information that we could have already quite easily picked up ourselves.
True. But just look at the way, I mean, if you look at the in the opening 5 minutes, the way in which Lundgren is speaking to his dad, you know what I mean? Like, he is speaking, he just keeps calling him old man. And he is just speaking to him with such a disdain. And actually, we don't even know that that's his dad. We, I mean, as a viewer, we don't know that it's his dad until later on when they show us some pictures. But for all we're concerned, is he has a shotgun to this poor old dude, to this poor old dude's face as he's, you know, drenching himself in water. You know what I mean? And then we find out later on that that's his dad. And so, and again, I can't help but wonder if, I don't know, it's easy to play, you know, Monday morning quarterback and, you know, look at it with 20/20 vision. But I can't help but wonder if that's one of the reasons why Dolph chose this role as his follow-up, where he was saying to himself, okay, I've proven that I can play a bad guy and I can do it quite well, but I also like also being a good guy. Who wouldn't? So he kind of chose his follow-up to Universal Soldier, where he can successfully play both sides. You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Where he can play both sides at, okay, he is the main character. He is going to be our hero. And I'm going to put that in loose quotes, but at the same time, I'm just going to say it. He is not a nice guy. I like this movie, but he's kind of an asshole, to be honest.
Yeah, no, he's not a particularly brilliant guy, it has to be said. And I think that scene does work particularly well, because like you say, in terms of Rita being the audience avatar, the audience surrogate at that stage, she is ahead of us. Like that works well. When he's just sticking up the old guy, we just think he's just like a random old guy. And then we find out as the scene unfurls that that's his father. And I do think one of the things I did like about this movie, and I think it's something that often attracts me to action movie, is that mixture of action and humor. And there is, it's not like a action comedy, it's not like a Shane Black movie or something like that, but there is a vein of humor in this movie that I did enjoy. And one of the first scenes that I think the humor kind of comes up, it is in those early interactions with Rita and the interactions with the old guy, where the old guy is like, yeah, what do you want me to do? You want me to fry you some eggs as well while we're at it? And, you know, there's some quippy lines that I enjoyed. Like also when Rita asks him, like, what did he do? What did he go to prison for? And Dolph quips that he turned away from Jesus. You know, that gave me a laugh. And I was like, oh, yeah, I'm into this film. Okay. Yeah, right. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm on board.
Yeah. I mean, he is, I mean, again, I mean, I already said it, but yeah, this is a guy, I think Lundgren has kind of had a lot of the same kind of sentiments that a lot of people have regarding a lot of these action dudes is, oh, they can't act. But I mean, he does a fantastic job, I think. You know what I mean? Again, he's playing a character that's straddling both lines. Okay. He's not a nice guy. He's not a particularly good guy, but for the duration of this film, there are worse people out there, I guess we can say. I think that's the best way of saying it. Actually, you know, I'm going to go back. Dolph is a bad guy in this movie, but in the end, there are worse people out there that he is going to take out. You know what I mean?
Well, I guess like that's the thing with it. Anytime you're creating a kind of anti-hero character, the reason that we support the anti-hero is you pit them against worse characters where you're just like, well, this guy isn't a good guy, but he's not as terrible as those guys. So I'm going to support this slightly mm-hmm. terrible guy because those are really terrible guys over there.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's one of those, it's that trope that we go along with anytime there's an assassin movie, exactly. Anytime your hero is an assassin. Okay. That's a bit of a tough sell, but you know what? In the end, those bad dudes had better be really, really mean if we're going to go. And so what they do, I mean, if you think about any of those assassin movies, for example, okay. I mean, we can rattle off, you know, a dozen of them right now if we wanted to, but if you notice with any of those movies, what they do is they always have the hitman, you know, he doesn't really have a heart of gold. Okay. But he has kind of his morals. Okay. There's the save the cat moment, if you will, where he's getting ready to take a shot, but oh, there's a little kid is in the way, or the person is holding up a baby or something like that. And so what they do in the film, which again, it's clear why they're doing it. There's the scene where Ken Foree's widow and son meet up with Santee, and they give him his shotgun, and they give him some clothes. And there's that scene where he starts comforting Ken Foree's son. And so you see that, and it's kind of like, oh, you know, maybe he is pretty nice here. You know what I mean? If you remember, it's a really kind of cool scene how they do it, where he starts kind of hassling the boy because the boy tells him, oh yeah, he stole the car or something like that. He was able to hotwire it. And Santee is like, do you really did that? And then he pulls him aside saying, what the hell are you doing? And then he immediately gives him a hug and tells him, you're better than this. And they clearly put that in to let you know, okay, yes, he is a badass. He is a felon who's escaped police custody, but he's also, you know what I mean? That there are some shades there that are going to help us sympathize with him and be on his side. And I think that's great writing right there. In the end, what that comes back to is that's fantastic writing.
Oh yeah. I think like that's one of those kind of key scenes to make sure that we know that he is the guy to root for. He may not be a great guy, but like, you know, because he really kind of scares the kid of being like, oh, well, you think that's cool? Well, you know, I'm going to be dead on Sunday. You know, like that's, mm-hmm, you know, yeah. That's, you know, don't end up like me. You know, I'm backed into a corner, you know, the kind of thing.
And he shouts it. He shouts it in that poor little kid's face with gritted teeth. I mean, you know what I mean? Like it's
absolutely. And I have to say, like, yeah, like you say, most of these action guys, you know, get stick for their acting. And to a certain extent, I don't think you need to be a great actor to be a great action star. Like, mm-hmm. I think that you need to have a screen presence. And you need to have like a physical presence that is impactful, and you need to be able to do the action scenes effectively. And the acting is, you know, certainly part of it, but you don't need to be, I don't know, like a De Niro or a Pacino or whatever. You just need to have, you know, give a powerful kind of presence. I mean, and a lot of these action guys aren't, you know, the greatest actors in the world, but they have a presence. And I do think that often these action stars probably do get more stick than they need to get. And I think that by and large, Dolph's acting here is as good as it needs to be, is as solid as it needs to be. I think in that kind of scene with the kids, he has like that little dramatic moment. And I think for the most part, he deals with all the kind of humorous lines very well. I think like his only, there's kind of two downfalls, I think. One, I don't think at this stage in his career, he's in terribly convincing when it comes to the trauma, you know, when he's waking up from the dream you know, seeing Ken Fury dying, like those kind of emotional moments are a bit iffy. And like most action stars, there's a love scene in this movie and it's very, very awkward.
God. Yeah. Well, you know what? I would argue as well. I mean, she is extremely easy on the eyes. Christian Alfonso, who I think is probably best known for on Days of Our Lives. Like, she's been on that soap opera for forever. But you know what? I would argue, and I know I'm going to, one of my best friends actually has been on my show quite a few times. I think he's going to strongly disagree with me, but I'm going to be honest. I do not really care for the Rita character. I think the whole kidnapping, you know, the grabbing a hostage. I mean, it's so cliche. It really is. It's so cliche to grab a hostage. And you think about it I mean, if you're going to put this in the real world, okay, I get why he's grabbing a hostage, but don't you think like, okay, if he is innocent, which he is, you're still kidnapping someone against their will. So in the end, you're committing another felony right there that isn't helping your case either. You know what I mean? So I'm not a fan of that angle. I get why they do it. Okay. It kind of helps move the narrative along, and by adding her character, it is able to kind of get out a lot of the exposition. You get a lot of exposition dump thanks to her character. Okay, but I mean, she is just—it's weird. She kind of comes from that era, okay, where she's like so awkwardly beautiful. You know what I mean? Like when we first see her, she's at this diner in the middle of nowhere, breaking up with her boyfriend at the time, I guess. And she's wearing high heels and like this dress skirt. And it's like, where is she going dressed like that? Like what is the purpose of this? I mean, and it's one of those things that's like 90s movies. We just kind of 90s action movies in particular. We got to kind of let that go. But it's one of those things where it's like, what is this here? Like,
yeah, it does seem strange that she's dressed like that just to go to the diner and not like a night on Broadway or something, like or like to a fancy restaurant. Yeah. Like, it is a bit odd.
yeah. I mean, and you know that they threw that in there purely for eye candy, you know, which again, it's 1993, Scott, fine. You know what I mean? Like, I'm gonna let it go.
I think there is some kind of, in those sorts of terms, there is some kind of, not, they're not problematic, they're just kind of gruesome. Yeah. Like, you know, they're being thrown in there as particular kind of eye candy moments, like when Dolph first kidnaps the Rita character, we get like numerous lingering cleavage shots that are like, yeah, that's unnecessary, but I, you know, it's the 90s. They feel like they have to throw this in there for the male audience, for the red bloodied male audience, you know, and it's like, yeah, you know, roll my eyes, move on. Yeah.
Well, I mean, and okay, she falls for her captor. Okay. So apparently we're supporting Stockholm syndrome here completely. You know what I mean? Like it's not a big surprise that she falls for him. But like you said, the love scene is just so awkward for a number of reasons. And number one, I don't think Dolph has ever really been, I don't think doing love scenes is really his strength. You know what I mean? And so, which is fine. You know what I mean? It never really worked, I don't think, for Stallone. And with Arnold Schwarzenegger, we never saw it with Schwarzenegger because it's very unsettling watching Arnold Schwarzenegger kiss a woman, to be honest. Yeah. So, you know, but I mean, so that right there is kind of hurting it. But then they do this thing where they're also eating this plant that is apparently indigenous to the Joshua Tree area of California. You know what I mean? And so like he's rubbing it on her, and so I guess it's supposed to be sexy, if you wanna call it that, but it just comes off as just more weird, and to be honest, kind of grotesque. Like it's just it's never worked for me when I saw it in 93, and then when I watched The Shout Blue again, it's one of those things that not a fan of.
Yeah, I was not a fan of it either. I did find it very awkward. Like you say, I think a lot of action stars struggle with these kind of scenes, and were kind of forced into them because commercially, filmmakers believed that the action movies needed to have love interest and love scenes, you know, to sell as an extra selling point. And I do think it's very strange. It starts very strangely. They're both eating this fruit kind of erotically. Maybe somebody on the crew had seen like 9.5 weeks or something like that. Of course, this is 1993, so the erotic thriller was still very big at the time. And then, yeah, like this kind of rubbing the kind of aloe vera on each other is very, it's very strange. It's very, and it's just like, you just want the scene to get over and done with. And it's just like, oh, it just feels, I don't know. Is something kind of sticky and horrible about it that's just like, okay, all right, we've had enough of this. I'm thankful for the train that interrupts and this scene going any longer.
Yeah, it's the motorcyclists, if I remember right. Aren't they like dirt bikes who come through and interrupt them? Yeah, and it's, thank God.
Yes, like there's a train that goes over the bridge. There's a train that goes over the bridge at the same time as the motorcyclists kind of come upon them. So it's kind of both at the same time, I think. Yeah.
I mean, and we could chalk it up to the fact that, I mean, you have a legendary stuntman turned director in the form of Vic Armstrong directing this. He's no slouch in the world of action movies, but it's kind of one of those things where, is he the best person to direct a scene of this nature? I would argue probably not. You know what I mean? He's not an Adrian Lyne, for example. You know what I mean? He could probably do it better. The other thing about this film, and it's interesting. Again, I have some people who will disagree with me harshly, and that's fine. But the other thing about this film that I've never really liked is the villain. Okay. Right. George Segal is a phenomenal actor. Okay. The dude's a legend. Okay. So just the very fact alone that Dolph Lundgren was able to star in a film alongside a legend like George Segal is amazing in itself, but he's playing the role so cartoonish. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, there's nothing wrong with your villain being a crooked cop. Okay, I mean that's an archetype that we've seen numerous times. But the problem is the way he's playing the character, the way he's chomping on that cigar. Okay, and then he's wearing that particular hat. It, for me at least, does not ring true. It almost feels like a caricature. And I'm thinking it could be a couple of things. It could be because, you know, when I saw this in recent years, I had seen, what was it? I believe it was The In-Laws. Okay. I'd seen him in The In-Laws where he's kind of playing the befuddled dad. And then he also did that sitcom, if you remember, throughout the 90s called Just Shoot Me.
Yeah.
So it could be perhaps because, you know, my memories of him are immediately tied to his comedic roles. So when you see him do that, when you see him do something like Joshua Tree, it's a little bit jarring, but I don't know. It's one of those things. And again, I it's pretty polarizing. I know some people think that he's one of the bright spots in this film. Me personally, it's more distracting, and it adds a level of camp to this particular film that I don't think the film needs. This particular film, Army of One, does not need a campy element in it. I don't think at all, considering what you have at its core. You have an escaped ex-con who's trying to clear his name, and you know what I mean? I mean, you don't need a campy, dirty detective who then is going to shout such grotesque vitriol. I mean, his, you know, when he, the way he speaks is just so misogynistic that it's like, oh man, not a fan.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's something that's often done, particularly at this era. I think it's done less now, where you have like the villain be like super misogynistic or like rough up women to kind of really prove to the audience that he's the villain. I feel like that's a kind of familiar trope. I kind of agree with you.
Which, okay, You know what I mean? I mean, which, I'm sorry, but I mean, okay, if that's what they want to do, I'm not saying that that is ever okay, you know, obviously in the real life or even in movies by today, but if that's what they're going to do in 1993, fine. Just don't make it George Segal. You know what I mean? I just don't think, and I can't help, and I'm sorry I interrupted you. I do apologize.
Oh, it's okay.
But I can't help but wonder if the production and the director saw that George Segal was available, and you know this is what happened, is they saw that he was available, and they were like, oh my gosh, he is a name. Let's get him. And it's one of those things where it's like, just because he's a name, like, I don't know. I mean, do you, I don't know, I'll let you go, but I mean, do you see what I'm saying? Did you agree, or did you like George Segal as Severance, I believe was his name?
Severance is his name. I'm on the fence about the character. Now, I have no problem with cartoonish villains. I'm a big fan of cartoonish villains. In fact, I've talked about this before on the podcast. I love Tommy Lee Jones in Under Siege. I love John Malkovich in Con Air. Over-the-top cartoonish villains are kind of my bag. But I am on the fence about this character, and I can definitely see where you're coming from. Because my associations with George Segal are mainly comedic. I didn't really believe him as a villain, because, you know, I think of him in things of, yeah, like that 90s sitcom he was in, things like Fun with Dick and Jane, stuff like that. I guess that made him less imposing as a villain. And also, I think tonally, you're right. I think for this movie, this movie is obviously referencing many things. Obviously, at one point he's watching High Sierra on the television, and that's shot in some of the same locations. But it seems to be very much rooted in kind of 70s exploitation, in things like The Getaway or Vanishing Point or stuff like that. So like a little bit more hard-edged. So for Dolph to exist in that sort of film, in the kind of Sam Peckinpah, The Getaway, that kind of thing, that he's in one movie and George Segal is in another movie. So George Segal is in a Smokey and the Bandit film. And so that tonally does kind of rub up against each other, I did find a little bit. Kind of like, as much as I enjoyed some of George Segal's like funny lines, because he does have some funny lines, and he, you know, he's a good actor and he delivers them very well. And like, there's the final chase scene where, you know, he's asking his partner to pass him a cigar, and then, you know, he's like, the guy's like, what, are you crazy? And then George Segal is like, what, do you want me to be nervous? You know, like, you know, there's certain lines like that that gave me a laugh that I was entertained by. But I think there is that kind of thing where it does sometimes feel like you're watching kind of two different films at once.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, I was kind of in the middle on it, I have to say. I didn't love the character, but I didn't hate the character either.
And it could also be, I mean, you know, another theory could also be that, okay, George Segal was at a point in his career where, you know, it's interesting. Dolph is at a point in his career after Universal Soldier where he's trying to get another big role that is going to elevate him. Okay. And then you have George Segal, who has been around for quite a while, and he suddenly gets that role that he is looking upon. And I'm not saying that, I don't want to speak ill of the deceased or anything like that, but it could also be that George Segal gets this role that he looks at as being, oh, it is just a Dolph Lundgren movie. You know what I mean? That he almost looks at as being a bit beneath him. So then he is purposely ratcheting up his performance to a level of camp because he views the film as kind of being beneath what he is used to doing. I'm not saying that this is, you know, I'm an expert and that's what it could be, but you almost kind of wonder if that's what's going on as well. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's highly possible. You know, action movies, you know, the two podcasts I have done, you know, cover action and horror, two genres that are generally kind of looked down upon. And I think maybe at this point, you know, obviously, I think probably the height of George Segal's career was probably the 70s with the things like The In-Laws and Fun with Dick and Jane and stuff like that. So maybe he did kind of mosey into this thinking like, it's just like a daft action film. I'm going to play it broad. I'm going to try and kind of chew the scenery, steal some scenes. And so maybe he did go into it with that. I mean, it's hard to know what his thoughts were. But I mean, it's certainly a possibility, I'm for sure.
What's also very interesting about this film is, okay, it's very clear that Vic Armstrong is trying new things and also copying and emulating what is popular and big at the time. I mean, case in point, obviously the Chop Shop shootout. Okay, there is an extended, you know, shootout sequence where Santee goes to talk to I believe his name is Jimmy Shoeshine, if I'm not mistaken.
That is Jimmy Shoeshine, played by Michael Polchan.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a wonderful character actor right there.
Absolutely.
Falling down, him as the convenience store clerk and falling down. Oh my goodness, that's a great scene right there. But what's interesting is that particular scene, it is an amazing shootout sequence, okay? But it's very clear that Vic Armstrong was influenced by the films of John Woo, which were starting on, at that point, 1993, were kind of on their way into America. We were starting to kind of see that particular style of filmmaking. And so it's very clear that is why he included that scene in the film. What's slightly, I mean, I love the scene, don't get me wrong. I mean, the way when Dolph is on the, I don't know what you want to call it, but it's what slides underneath the cars the mechanics use.
Yeah.
Right. The little dolly, if you will. But when he's sliding on that with a gun in each hand, blasting everyone away, I mean, it just looks so cool. But what's so funny about it is it's like, okay, number one, I don't know how a car thief is so, you know, so amazing with a gun. Okay. But also, if you really wanted, you could theoretically take that scene out of the film completely. You could completely excise that scene, and the narrative is still going to work just fine. It's a great scene, okay? I'm not saying I don't want it out, but you could take it out, and it's going to, I think, in the end, play, you know, the movie's going to play just fine. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I agree with you about the shootout. You could take that scene out, and it wouldn't affect the overall plot and narrative of the movie. Like, you know, I do love the scene. It's very well done. Like you say, it is a bit confusing. You know, this guy, as far as we know, the only information we have about this guy is he's a former racing car driver. He's a car thief. We know he can do that. He obviously works out because he's Dolph Lundgren. But yeah, where all this shooting skill comes from, who knows? But it is really fun. I think like part of the problem of the scene is it does feel like a finale to a film. And this scene happens about an hour in, and the movie's just over an hour and 40. So, like, as much as the actual finale of the film is still fun, it is overshadowed by this scene. But I still love the scene. I still love that they put it in, like you, the dolly shot where he's firing the two guns, sliding along on that. And when he's actually going on the dolly down a slide as well, shooting off a gun, that's really fun. And also, it gives us this film's most entertaining mini subplot, where Michael Polchan's character of Johnny Shoeshine, he has like, I don't know, I think we're supposed to take it, a number one henchman. A number one henchman says that, you know, this Santee guy, he's just a driver, not a killer. I'll take him out, no bother. We get a fun fight scene between Dolph and this guy. And then Dolph stabs him in the neck and then runs the blade down his throat into his chest. But number one henchman does not die and actually comes back a few scenes later out of nowhere. Pops out of a Ferrari and attacks Dolph again. And I just found this, I don't know, it was one of the highlights of the film for me. Like, what was your thoughts on that, Sean?
Yeah, I mean, again, Vic Armstrong, this is a guy who, I believe, what was he? Wasn't he Harrison Ford's stunt double
Yeah, I think on Raiders, yeah. I think on the Indiana Jones movies, yes. I think it was Harrison Ford, don't know. Yeah.
So this is a guy who knows the genre and knows how to do those particular scenes, similar to Craig Baxley, the director of Dark Angel or I Come in Peace. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I mean, it's such a cool scene. I mean, he's using dual-handed weapons, which, again, John Woo. You know what I mean? So that right there. And then he's even using it's not a full-on flamethrower, but, you know, he's using one of the isn't it like the gas, like the gas nozzle? Yeah, right. He's using that as a flamethrower to, you know. He's also kicking a barrel.
I think it's the thing they use for like paint stripper, and then he just lights.
Oh, that's it. Yeah,
like he kind of lights a lighter in front of it and like sets it on fire. And apparently, I was reading kind of background information. Apparently, like Dolph kind of blew that tank because he was so shocked by Andy Armstrong, because the whole Armstrong family are stuntmen. Andy Armstrong going up in flames and doing the full body burn, which is, you know, obviously probably the most dangerous stunt you can do. It's mm-hmm. kind of the number one that stuntmen are kind of cautious to do.
I want to get your take real quick. I mean, this is kind of a nitpicky thing to point out, but it's one thing that's always kind of stood out to me on my respective show. One of the things we always, it's not like it's a sticking point that I always, am noticing, but I mean, we always seem to reference it on the show, which is interesting, but mm-hmm. it's Dolph's attire. Okay. If you look at, I always like to look at the wardrobe with the costume designer, you know, set up for the film. And because it's one of the things that for me is one of the most unique and memorable, but also kind of head scratching. So if we're to believe, okay, Lundgren, his character is, he's on the run. Okay. But he's also trying to remain inconspicuous slightly. And so the clothing that they give him black pants and this button up short sleeve, shirt that he has tucked in, but is also halfway buttoned down his chest. You know what I mean? And it has the pockets on each breast or whatever. And so it's one of those things where it's like, first of all, that's not very conspicuous clothing right there. And so I don't know. It's one of those things where it's like, okay, they clearly dressed him this way so that, you know, he can show off his biceps or whatever. But even in 1993, I would question if anybody would wear wear that particular shirt and that outfit. I mean, he looks cool in it. I'll give him that. But it's one of those things where, I mean, do you see what I'm saying? Or is that, mm-hmm. am I getting too nitpicky there for you there, Scott?
No. First of all, yes, it's not a very inconspicuous outfit. And sometimes, yeah, I think like in action movies, that's kind of the stuff that sometimes you need to get let go. Because I am up to a point, I am accepting when films kind of follow the rule of cool, which is like, it doesn't make sense, but it looks cool. And some movies take it too far and you're just like, okay, none of this makes sense. And you're just trying to be cool for the sake of it. But, just sprinkling it throughout, I'm kind of fine with. So I think they're kind of, following that. And I think also like there, I don't know. I do feel like there's a lot of kind of, there is a kind of very throwback feel to this. So I think they're kind of, you know, it's not like people are dressed like it's the 70s or anything, but I do feel like there is an element of that, of like everything kind of looks and feels a little bit like a 70s movie. And I feel like that's kind of like a kind of conscious choice on Vic Armstrong's part, that he's kind of I don't know. Did you pick up on that? Did you get that?
I get that. I certainly see that. Yeah. Well, I guess if you frame it like that, yeah, I could see that. And I guess maybe even a Western. I think this is a modern day Western, so it only makes sense to dress Lundgren as a as a cowboy, if you will, you know, in modern day. So yeah, I certainly understand that. And it's just one of those things where already he is a very rarefied being. So seeing him walk the street or whatever is going to be interesting. But then in that particular you know, almost it's almost like something Fabio would wear, you know, on the cover of one of those romance novels. You know what I mean? And so, in any case, you know, I will say regarding Vic Armstrong, you know, if we look at the end, because it seems like that's kind of where we're going, the one cool thing about this particular film is, again, narratively, Lundgren's character is a car thief slash former racer. So it only makes sense for the film to end with a car chase. And man, is the car chase filmed cool? I mean, nowadays they would probably just use drones, you know, for a lot of those shots. They would probably use pretty much all CGI, to be perfectly honest. But the fact that they had these two wicked looking sports cars, I think it is hilarious that apparently Severance just hops in the black one and Dolph hops in the red Ferrari, right? But the fact that they're filming that scene in the mountains like they are, you know that they had some helicopters go up in the sky and they are actually physically shooting that particular scene. And it looks great. I mean, again, from a narrative standpoint, if your lead character is going to be a supposed former driver, okay, then yeah, you'd better have the climax end with a race. And on that front, they definitely deliver. That's one thing that obviously should not be cut.
Oh, absolutely not. And I think that's where Vic Armstrong's strength as a director comes out. Because, you know, the film is directed, you know, solidly for the most part. The dramatic scenes are, you know, kind of fine. They're not flashily shot. They're just solid, competent. But where he comes into his own is particularly these two scenes: the warehouse sequence, which is really well shot, really well edited, and this finale, this final car chase, where, like you say, we get these brilliant aerial shots, and you know, it's a really fun car chase to watch. I do love, you know, sometimes you know, I try to find background information on these films, and sometimes try and find articles and like, and I always read the like IMDb trivia and stuff like that, some of which is complete bullshit. IMDb trivia, very hit and miss. But I do love the kind of, you know, you were talking about Dolph's attire. And I do love like what people focus on, because in terms of like goofs and things like that, because like if you look at a lot of action movies on IMDb, you'll always get somebody who's like, well, this gun doesn't do that, da 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 da. And I'm like, I don't care. But like, it's fun that you're interested in that. So obviously on this one, we have some sort of petrol head who went on IMDb because, like, it was stuck in their bonnet that the Ferrari F40 that Dolph is driving is actually much faster and much more nimble than the Lamborghini Countach that George Segal is driving, but they're depicted in the film as being quite evenly matched. And I just, it's just things like that I find quite entertaining, just the little details that people get hung up on. And I'm not dragging that person's down for it, because sometimes I get hung up on a little detail that nobody else notices as well. So I just think it's fun what different people, the eyes that different people watch movies with.
Yeah, I mean, sorry, I hate bringing it up, but you know, that was always one of the things. But yeah, I mean, that's what's so cool is, and again, it's one of those things where it's like, okay, these two, you know, super powered sports cars. These, you know, foreign sports cars, I think we should say, are racing through this mountain. And it's one of the things, you know, that there is going to be the final fight. It's going to take place on top of the mountain where someone is going to fall off. You know what I mean? It's one of the, yeah. I mean, that's one of the things is, anytime you're going up to a high place, well, that's what's going to happen. It's kind of action movie shorthand. The thing that this film does that I really, really like, okay, I mean, it does a number of things that I really like. But one of the film's strengths is the set and the scenery. Okay, mm-hmm. I'm a firm believer in that. Location scouting is a character in itself. Okay, that set that you create, wherever it takes place, it has to be a character. Okay, and this goes everywhere from, you know, Rocky. Okay, the city of Philadelphia is just as much a character as Rocky. all the way to something like The Evil Dead. Okay. I mean, that's a confined setting within a single room cabin, but it is even a stronger character, I think, than Bruce Campbell. And so what this film does is, okay, the film's initial title is Joshua Tree. And man, that California landscape and mountainous locale and just the whole area of Joshua Tree is a central character that is alongside Dolph as being a focal point in the film. And Vic Armstrong does a wonderful job in not only shooting it, but also including it through pretty much every narrative beat of the film. You know what I mean?
I absolutely know what you mean. And when you've got, you know, it's hard to kind of shoot it poorly when you've got like such a spectacular landscape like that to work with, you know. And I think that something that we haven't talked about actually that I think works really well as well, and I think, like you say, the landscape itself becomes a character, but I think what makes that character even more full-bodied is the kind of very deserty Joel Goldsmith score that goes with that landscape.
Right. That was going to be my next point. Yeah. Yeah, no, you're exactly right. Yeah, the score complements the setting wonderfully. And surprisingly, it has not been released on an official album of some kind. But yeah, no, you're exactly right. His score that not only opens the film, but carries the film all the way throughout to its end is absolutely beautiful. It kind of has like this this like twang, you know what I mean, to it, also mixed with it. And it's very simple, but no, you're exactly right.
Yeah, it kind of has like, yeah, like an almost like a kind of bluesy Stevie Ray Vaughan type twang, you know, like, yeah, I think it's really I was surprised actually, like you, that it's not being released. I thought it was really good. I was seeing if, you know, maybe been released, looking on Spotify and stuff like that, but no sign of it. But no, I think like he does an excellent job. And also like kind of cutting to the, you know, finale, like you say, on the clifftop. One thing that I did appreciate about the Rita character, even though like you, I wasn't a massive fan of the character, it's one of those things that, you know, I think, you know, at this time it was just like a love interest. We need to have a love interest character, so we need to, you know, have something there. But one thing I did like about the writing of that character is that we've covered a number of 90s action movies on this podcast, where there is a female character, a female sidekick or a love interest who is capable and witty and seems to have a brain in act one, but seems to have lost all those qualities by act three. Just becomes completely helpless, and, you know, that's it. Whereas the Rita character actually still remains relatively badass throughout, and like even manages to briefly escape George Segal, like by like beating him up a little, and so her capabilities don't seem to reduce as the movies goes on in the same way that I've seen in a lot of other ways, which I thought was an admirable aspect to the writing.
Yeah, no, most definitely. But I do have to laugh. Okay, I mean it's one of those things. Okay, this is nitpicky, but it's one of those things. It is interesting how at the beginning of the film, she is breaking up with, what is that actor's name?
Because Matt Battaglia.
Matt Battaglia, that's it, yeah. Interestingly, he ended up taking over for Van Damme for the Canadian made-for-TV sequel to Universal Soldier. I don't know if you knew that or not.
Yes, I did read that, yes. Yeah. I've not seen those ones, but yeah.
But it is just very, very interesting how the film opens, or excuse me, when she first comes into the movie, she is breaking up with him, okay, Matt Battaglia, and he is just this nice, you know, good guy cop, okay? And then the last we see of Rita at the end of the movie, she is embracing with Santee's character, who is this escaped ex-con character. And it's just one of those things where it's like, man, women really do prefer the bad boys, don't they? Like, it's the nice guys that finish last. They, all women want the bad boy. Apparently.
Well, according to the movies, anyway, like, I think that is the, that is the stereotype for sure. Yeah.
So, yeah. But overall, I mean, it's one of those films where, you know, it's interesting. I would agree with you completely. I don't think Dolph's acting in the dramatic scenes is maybe at its best. However, I do think he does a very solid, competent job in the other scenes. I think one of his, the standout acting moment for me is, again, where he is Ken Foree's son, how he's kind of turning him straight. I just think his little monologue there is wonderful. But in the end, I think anyone who ever comes to me and says, man, Dolph Lundgren, you have a podcast about him, that the guy can't act. I always would put, obviously he got a ton of acting acclaim for Creed 2. Okay, I don't want to discredit that. But I always say, you know what, you need to check out Men of War and Army of One. Okay, fortunately, Men of War is readily available. You can find that one. Army of One, you got to do a little bit of digging. You said that it's on YouTube, apparently. So yeah, but I think those are two films in his CV that have really, I wouldn't even say really have been forgotten. They're kind of undiscovered, to be perfectly honest. You know what I mean? I don't think they ever were given a fair shake, even upon their release. So,
I mean, yeah, he did performs pretty well. I recently watched Men of War not that long ago, just a couple of months ago. So I think he does a decent job in that. I would definitely agree. He does a decent job, even though I do think overall the movie is stolen by B.D. Wong. But like, I do think that, like, I think Dolph is good in that. And it's a good film. I do agree that people should check it out. I will also put the YouTube link if people want to check this movie out, which I think they should, actually, because we've talked about some of the pitfalls of the film. We've talked about some of the things that don't quite work for us. You know, you're not a big fan of the villain. I was kind of on the fence about the villain, although I liked some moments with him. And yet the Rita character is maybe surplus to requirements. But there is some really good action here. The finale, that final car chase, is great. The warehouse shootout is great. While it is very thin on plot, and most of the characters are not never kind of get out of being kind of two-dimensional, I do think that some of the dialogue is very fun. I think there's a lot of fun dialogue in the movie, and there's not like I say, it's not a straight up action comedy. That's not the kind of movie we're at, but there is a nice little dollop of humor on top as well throughout the movie that I think elevates it a little bit further. And so yeah, I would definitely recommend that people check this one out, because like you say, I think it's maybe an underseen effort in Dolph's filmography and just in 90s action films generally. So I don't know, I guess we're kind of at the time of final thoughts, and I guess I've already given my final thoughts, but Sean, if you want to give any final thoughts or anything that we've not talked about the movie that you feel should be flagged up.
I mean, I think we've hit all of the points. This is a very unseen film of Dolph's. I think even by a lot of action completists, this is one particular film that just never really gets talked about. I mean, how many top 15 lists? It seems like any time a Creed movie comes out or an Expendables movie comes out or something like that, all these articles always come up online, you know, charting the top 10 Dolph Lundgren movies. You know what I mean? And it's always the same ones. And this is one that is just, you know, like I said, it's been forgotten. I like to say it came from the era of Dolph, is that I've kind of coined the experimental era. So I would say from about 1993 to 96, 97, I've coined that the experimental era, because this is the era where Dolph was he was doing films that were intended to be released theatrically, and they were never given the fair shake, and they all, for the most part, with the exception of Johnny Mnemonic, they all went direct to video. But if you look at all those films, he's trying something new in every one of them. Okay, post Universal Soldier, he does this particular film. Okay, he did Pentathlon. Pentathlon is not good, but again, he's playing a different character. He does Men of War, which we talked about, is amazing. He did Silent Trigger, where he's playing the kind of silent assassin, but with a moral compass. You know what I mean? All of those films. Oh, and Johnny Mnemonic, he's playing a deranged preacher. You know what I mean? Every one of those films, again, they have a polish and a sheen about them to where you can tell that they were intended to go theatrical, but sadly, that's not the direction they went. But every one of those films, he's trying something different. And while they all fall in the action genre, he's at least playing a new character. So I would say if anyone has not seen, we've come back and forth in referring to it as both Joshua Tree and Army of One. Okay, both titles. I mean, I'm kind of indifferent to both titles, to be perfectly honest. But obviously, if you can watch it on YouTube, I guarantee people are not going to be disappointed. I guarantee people are not going to be bored. It's, again, it's Dolph. He's carrying the same look and physique and everything that he had in Universal Soldier. So it's pretty much if the idea of Andrew Scott driving a Ferrari and rubbing aloe on a the Days of Our Lives star in a very awkward love scene sounds appealing, then by all means, check it out.
Yeah, absolutely. We probably shouldn't sell it in the love scene. Warehouse scene.
That's what we'll say. The completely unnecessary but absolutely fun warehouse shootout scene. There you go. We'll sell it on that.
Yes, I think we definitely should sell on that, because that is undoubtedly the highlight of the movie. And I mean, it is one of those things, like, it's one of those things. I love how ridiculous it is. Apparently, I also love that it was just thrown in there because, like you say, Vic Armstrong just like John Woo movies, and he was like, let's do this. Because apparently in the original script, he only killed like 5 guys in the warehouse, but they changed it on shooting. And so it's like just, it becomes like a Bond movie where like suddenly dozens of people come from nowhere just to line up to be shot. So, but yeah, and it's squibtastic. And it's really fun. And the one on YouTube, thankfully, is the unrated edition. It's not the heavily cut UK edition that came out, that was took away all the bloody squibbiness of that scene. So you get the your full money's worth on the edition I found. I think that's pretty much brings us to the end of the podcast. Before we head on out, Sean, just plug away your podcast. Tell everybody about your podcast, where they can find it, and obviously we are podcasting buddies, as we're both on the Last of the Action Heroes network. Give any social media information, anything you want to plug.
Well, thank you. I do appreciate that. To anyone who is listening and would like to hear me drone on more about the extensive filmography of Mr. Lundgren, the show is called I Must Break This Podcast. We are almost at 100 episodes. And we are available on iTunes, Stitcher, also on Facebook. You can follow us on Facebook as well. But it's been a ton of fun. And the great thing about the show is, in addition to reviewing and discussing these particular films, I've also gotten to chat with many of the individuals who've been able to, who've had a hand in making these films. So everyone from directors to screenwriters to actors, stunt performers, you know, everyone who's helped make these films the final products that they are have been on the show. So in addition to all of the review episodes, there's also quite a few interview episodes that I've been very blessed to get to speak with these individuals. So I recommend, and you know, my buddy Chris said it perfectly. Even if you're not a fan of Mr. Lundgren, I think there is some fun to be had, because in the interview episodes, I've been you really get a great inside look at just the world of independent low budget filmmaking and how difficult it really is. So I think it's been interesting on that front, and I really do appreciate you having me on. Thank you very much. This was a ton of fun getting to revisit this film that I don't think I did. I'll just be honest. I know I didn't do the best job covering on my initial run 5.5 years ago. So thank you.
Well, that's no problem at all. It's a pleasure to have you on. I would recommend all my listeners check out your podcast. It is a lot of fun. And I think I mentioned earlier, it's kind of been my kind of gateway to Dolph. He wasn't particularly one of my guys as a kind of growing up. I've watched several of his films over the last year, so that's thanks to you and your podcast. And yeah, you've managed to get some great guests on the podcast as well. So like you know, interviews with the likes of Patrick Kilpatrick and Vince DiCola, who did the music to Rocky IV, and a bunch of other people. The review shows are also good. So definitely, listeners, check that out. And also, if you want to give this podcast some love, you can by rate, reviewing, and subscribing on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. I used to say Stitcher, but I don't think Stitcher exists anymore. So not there now. And yes, so do that. 5 stars, please. It really helps with the algorithm and all that. If you want to reach out to us on social media, you can via our... I guess I have to call it X now. Ugh. but you know, Twitter. It's Twitter. So you can follow us there and give us any feedback there. Or if you want to just give me feedback, you can also can at ScottMurphy85. And yeah, that's it. That's all for this episode. So it just leaves me to say thanks again for listening, and tune in next month, when we will be covering, wait for it, Hard Target. You know, tying it all in. John Woo referencing movie to actual John Woo movie. So join us then. I'm sure that episode will be a lot of fun. Until then, though, see ya. We'll be right back.